Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Potter coming at you live from my house. Thank God I came back safe and sound from Blue Ash. It's book club day. It's Monday, March 27 of the year 23. We're continuing our study of the book, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, Volume 1. We're on page 164. Let's get right to it. Today we learn about the Volozhiner Yeshiva, the famous, the world famous, built bevusly Volozhiner Yeshiva, created by none other than Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, who was the premier student of the Vilna Gaon. Volozhiner Yeshiva basically opened up its doors in or around 1802 to try to give you some sort of perspective on history 200 years ago. 220 years ago, the Volozhiner Yeshiva opened, and it closed at or around 1892. We're not going to get into the opening and the closing. We can certainly talk about the closing and the circumstances, but we won't, because it's not that relevant to what we want to do today. Today we're going to read about Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik and stories that he knows about the Volozhiner Yeshiva, the impact that it's made, and what it's all about. And let's get right to it. Page 164, the Volozhiner Yeshiva, constant Torah study. Excuse me, this was related by Rabbi Soloveitchik to his Gemara Shir, his Talmud class at Yeshiva University, when the author, Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf, when he himself was a student at YU. I think he was in Rabbi Soloveitchik's class. Here's what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. The rabbis stated as follows in the Talmud, recorded in Gemara Shabbos 88a. The Almighty God, the Holy One, blessed be He, stipulated, God made an arrangement with the works of creation, the cosmos, that they would only continue to exist if Israel accepted the Torah. If not, God would turn the works of creation back into emptiness and formlessness. By the way, the reason why the Talmud says that is because there's a famous verse in Jeremiah, if I'm not mistaken. And the pasuk says, the Hebrew is escaping at the moment, the exact language in the Hebrew is escaping me, but the English goes something like this. If not for my covenant day and night, then the ways of heaven and earth I would not have placed, I would not have set, or I would not have created, if you will. So those are kind of the words, imlo brisi, if not for the ways of, Pasuk in Jeremiah, if not for the way the cosmos work, if not for my covenant, rather, then heaven and earth I would not have placed. So what does that mean? So the rabbis take that to mean, if not for the bris, if not for the covenant being the agreement, the arrangement between God and Israel, to observe the Torah, then heaven and earth, you know, it wouldn't continue. It would just kind of fall into complete and utter chaos. There is that drush that's out there, and it's a good one, and it's recorded in Gemara Shabbos. Now, there's a slightly more, it could be that it's talking about Shabbos Kodesh per se, that if not for my bris, if not for my covenant where you're supposed to keep Shabbos, then heaven and earth, like, why did I create it? I only created the heavens and the earth for the sake of being able to have a Shabbos in the world. There should be a Shabbos that people would keep. And the rabbis go a step further, and they say that the bris is not, if I'm not mistaken, they do darshan on Shabbos, and they darshan also on the idea of a covenant, meaning the covenant of the Torah itself between God and Israel, and how we have to keep the covenant, and if we don't do it, well, then there was no sense in even creating the cosmos. Because the Torah is God's will. And if we're not going to keep it, what's the sense in being here? What's it all about? If human beings, if Jews don't do the Torah, so then why did God go out of his way to create a cosmos? If only to have a people who would learn Torah and keep the Torah, and in such a way, they would be an example for mankind. Not for us. There's no reason for anything to be around. That's the Jewish perspective. And it's founded on a pasuk in Jeremiah. And it's a I think it's a very nice drush. I don't think it's crazy. I think it's very Ice Carlton. Personally, I think it's a very, it holds together very well. Now, let's continue with that idea. The Vilna Gaon held that the world would only endure if the Jews did not just accept the Torah, which they did 3,000 years ago, but they continued to constantly study the Torah. The Grof felt that if we don't continuously study the Torah, then we don't have a cosmic, like divinely cosmic merit to keep going, to keep the world going. It's only the study, the intellectual study of the Torah that keeps the world functioning. Very Lithuanian idea, if you want. It's also kind of a Hasidic idea. And I think Rabbi Slifkin, when he spoke at Shaarei Torah recently, and in his book, which I have to crack open and start reading eventually, so much for me to get to. But the point is, there are two ways to look at the Torah. One, it's a prescription for how to behave. How do I know how to do the mitzvah? Well, you got to sit and learn. How else do you know how to do sukkah, tefillin, mezuzah, how to keep Shabbos, how to keep Yontif? What can you and can you not do? So many things. 39 malachas, the laws of prayer, laws of charity. I could go on. I won't, because you know where I'm going. There's a lot to learn. And one aspect is the rational approach. The reason why you learn Torah is to be able to do the Torah. That's a perfectly sensible way to go about things. And that's the rational approach. The mystical approach is, when you learn Torah, then you are affecting great things up in the cosmos. Up in heaven, the Almighty smiles upon you and all Israel, because you're learning the Torah, and the Torah is the, if you will, the mind of God, the will of, it's the will of God. That God is sharing with us his very will. He wants us to get to know him a little bit. How are you going to get to know a mysterious entity like the Almighty God? How do you get to know such a being? Well, you sit down and you study, the prophets and the laws and the sages and their interpretations, and you slowly begin to understand where God's coming from. He wants moral, behavior, chastity, and he wants us to behave with love toward each other. It's all there. I mean, it's all written. What you got to do is open it up and see it. And when you study the Torah, you're effectuating these great cosmic levers up in heaven. That's the mystical approach. So, and I think the Vilna Gaon is definitely going down that way. Even though he's the ultimate Lithuanian, still I think that that's where he's going. And the Rav Chaim Volozhiner, his student, who writes the book Nefesh HaChaim, is kind of countering the Hasidim. The Hasidim were into, obviously, joy and dance and happiness, and that's all important. And I'm not impugning that. I myself come from Hasidic stock, Alexander Hasidim. Okay, the Hasidus of Alexander and Gur and others kind of took over Poland back in the day. What's my point? The point is that Chaim Volozhiner wanted to create a written manifesto for Lithuanians to rally around. The Vilna Gaon had not really done that. The Vilna Gaon wrote prodigiously and interpreted and commented upon virtually every single part of Torah imaginable in the form of commentary. But Chaim Volozhiner, he wrote a book that we, God willing, yes indeed, will get to. I want to do Rabbi Soloveitchik properly and honor him this year, his 120th anniversary of his birth. And then, B'li Nadir, without making any promises, as soon as we finish Rabbi Soloveitchik, we'll go straight into Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, and we will begin the study of Nefesh HaChaim. It's in translation. It's a beautiful translation. We'll understand it. It's going to be a great read. Nefesh HaChaim is the Lithuanian approach to life, and it's the counter Jewish approach to Hasidut, Torah study, and more Torah study. While the Hasidim were emphasizing joy and happiness, singing and dancing, and I don't want to minimalize and trivialize the great ones among them and all the good things that Hasidus has brought to the Jewish people, and it has injected a lot of life into Jewish people. No doubt, Rav Moshe said that. Everybody agrees to it. But if you're going to slightly demote the study of Torah in even a small way, the Vilna Gaon was not into that at all. It wasn't. You have to be sitting and learning Taganach. You want to get to know God? We got the prescription. Open up a Bible, open up a Talmud, open up a Midrash, open up any Sefer, and you will instantaneously be getting connected to the Almighty. That is a Lithuanian approach. And what can I say? I was raised like that. And the more and more I studied, the more I begin to realize that it's 101% right. You want to get to know God? There's a way to do it. You want to talk to God? You go pray. You want God to talk to you? Go study some Torah. I'm totally down with that now. And I'm so glad that I've rediscovered the power of Torah study. I'm so grateful for that. And I love sharing it. We continue with the book now. Again, the Vilna Gaon held that the world would only endure if the Jews didn't just accept the Torah, but continued to constantly study the Torah. The Vilna Gaon student, Chaim Volozhiner, later incorporated these ideas into his work, Nefesh HaChaim, which, as I said, God willing, we'll read. It's going to be a great read. In accordance with this concept, Chaim Volozhiner instituted in the Volozhiner Yeshiva that there would be constant study of the Torah. At no time was the voice of Torah study to be silent in the Volozhiner Yeshiva. There in the Yeshiva of Volozhin, there were always students who studied by night and slept during the day. In addition to those who kept the more conventional schedule of studying by day and resting by night. There was even study on Shabbos afternoons after the Mincha prayer, a time when it was customary not to study. Listen to this. In Volozhin Yeshiva, Shabbos afternoon, after Mincha, that was a time when it was customary not to study as a sign of mourning, because Moshe Rabbeinu had passed around that time. And so it is written in the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim, 292. Until I opened up this book, I got to tell you, I never knew that there was ever such an idea, that Volozhin did that, that it's written, it's geschrieben in the Shulchan Aruch Hazai, that you have to cut down on your Torah study on Shabbos afternoon after Mincha as a sign of avelus, because Moshe passed away around that time. And I was in yeshiva for 3 years. I never even heard that. I don't get that. That's incredible. And we have a Shalat Yudis. It's like the apex of Shabbos after Mincha. I don't even know what to say. I mean, are they davening Mincha early on Shabbos afternoon in Volozhin? And then they kind of not study, though? That's kind of, how did that work? There was even study in Shabbos afternoons, when normally some people kind of minimize it. That's the point here. While most of the students studied easier subjects, like the weekly Parsha or Pirkei Avos, one student was designated to continue the more profound yeshiva studies. One student studied Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat, at that time, and truly became an expert in this division of the Code of Jewish Law. Even at the conclusion of Yom Kippur, when the entire yeshiva went to eat, the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, famously known as the Netziv, he remained in the Beis Medrash, and he studied Torah. Only after the first students had finished their repast, only when the first students finished eating and returned to the Beis Medrash and their studies, did the Netziv break his fast. Now, you got to admit, that's pretty impressive. Admit that after Yom Kippur, I don't know if you're hungry so much as you are thirsty, and there's the Netziv just sitting and learning, waiting for the bachur to come back from eating a little bit so he can then go eat and drink a little bit after the whole long fast of Yom Kippur. The dedication to Torah study on the part of our great ones is absolutely awesome. That's just how it is. Even at the conclusion of Yom Kippur, it's an amazing thing. Page 165, we continue. Pride and vanity. related by Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi David Derevan was his student. And Rabbi Derevan was interviewed June 1993. While studying the rabbinic dictum, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking, while studying the rabbinic dictum that, quote, the Torah is destined to be forgotten in Israel. Amazing. Gemara in Shabbos 138b. Rabbi Soloveitchik elaborated upon the concept that pride and vanity also caused the Torah to be forgotten. To illustrate this point, Rabbi Soloveitchik told the following story about the Volozhiner Yeshiva. Rav Chaim Volozhiner, the Rosh Yeshiva, generally never met privately with students. The only exceptions were his private meetings with his outstanding student, Rabbi Yaakov Schick, who passed in 1844, and who later authored the Mishkanot Yaakov. This student, Rabbi Schick, was later known as Rabbi Yaakov Karliner, because he served as the rabbi of Karlin, Lithuania, for over 30 years. After he left the yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov would periodically return to visit with his Rebbe. On these occasions, he would be alone with Rav Chaim Volozhiner in the Rosh Yeshiva's study, where a lively discussion would ensue. Top page 166. The students in the Volozhiner Yeshiva were very curious to know what transpired between these two great scholars when they were alone. Once the students prepared a hiding place on the roof above Reb Chaim's study. Sounds like Hillel getting on top of the base medrash back in the day in ancient Israel 2,000 years ago to listen to a shir because he couldn't get in. He didn't have a kopek. He didn't have a dinar or whatever, a shekel. They didn't let him in. So he got on top of the roof so he could hear it. So these guys, too, are going to get on top of the roof. They prepared a hiding place on the roof above the Rosh Yeshiva study so they could eavesdrop on the conversation. You know you got to be wondering about that, though. I mean, they want to hear a private conversation. Why not just open up people's mail, too, while you're at it? I mean, where does it end? You want to listen in because you're curious? You want to hear what two rabbis are talking to each other? You're a little bit jealous? You're not invited into the study, into his chambers? You'd like to be, but you're not, so you therefore are going to hear him have a conversation with somebody else. Isn't he entitled to a little privacy? This whole thing is very troubling. I mean, these are like the Volozhiner Yeshiva guys. What's the heter for this? If a Moshe Feinstein wanted to talk to somebody in private, who am I to go ahead and start staying underneath his desk? Who am I to do that? It reminds me of the great rabbi whose student wanted to know how he had intimacy with his wife. So he hides underneath the bed of the great rabbi, his mentor, and he's there during the whole session. And I guess he coughs, he sneezes, he grunts, I don't know what he's doing, but he makes himself known accidentally, I suppose. And the great mentor, his rabbi, must have recognized the cough or the sneeze and said, "What are you doing here? This is a private moment. You can't be in here." So the guy says, "Well, you know, this is Torah, and also I got to know this too. I get you. I understand this, that Torah extends to everything. Everything, it means everything. But there ought to be limits. I mean, really, I mean, you can't be doing that. You got to say to yourself, there are parameters here of good taste, and I have to allow people to have privacy. And instead of, you know, being underneath somebody's bed, how about I just have him, you know, give me a one-on-one session, you know, me and him privately, I'll ask him for a one-on-one session, and we'll talk out how to go about behaving like a married man." That's not improper. On the contrary, it's very proper. And indeed, recently here in Cincinnati alone, Rabbi David Horowitz of Los Angeles, the Musmuch of Near Israel, was brought in by Goffman Synagogue. And we had a steaks and schnapps night. And what do you think he talked about? I'm not kidding. He talked about this very thing. How to be a properly married man. How to behave oneself in intimate situations. Listen, I was amazed at the fact that he decided to talk about that. But this is true. Torah extends to everything. Even to that? Especially to that. So that you know how to behave yourself. Some men are clueless. Some men are a little bit more advanced. So everybody's got to be put on the same page. Me, I was just listening very intently, and I kept on eating. Because that was my job, to listen and to eat. I got the lesson. Now, so they go up on the roof. Let's go back to Chaim Volozhiner. Two of the Volozhiner students climbed up to the roof to observe the next private encounter between Chaim Volozhiner and Rabbi Yaakov Karliner. This is what they saw and heard. The author of the Mishkanos Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Karliner, came into the room and sat down. This is actually very delicious. And they actually watched this, like theater. They're watching this. It's all unscripted, and the parties on stage have no idea they're being watched by an audience. So their guards are down, and they're talking to each other, and people listening in. I mean, I think it's illegal and usher, but we have the story. Might as well share it. So Rabbi Yaakov Karliner, the student, came into the room and sat down. For a few minutes, the Rebbe and the disciple engaged in small talk and caught up on what had been happening in their personal lives. Then Rav Chaim Volozhiner said, "I have a difficult question, which perhaps you can answer." Rav Chaim took out the Gemara Zevachim and pointed to the Tosfos at the beginning of the tractate, which dealt with the concept that, quote, sacrifices slaughtered with undefined purpose were valid. Gemara Zevachim 2b. Rav Chaim Volozhiner asked his student, "What was the difficulty with the viewpoint of Tosfos?" Rabbi Yaakov soon asked the proper question, but could not formulate a solution. While the student continued to ponder the Tosfos, Rav Chaim Volozhiner reprimanded him. "What is this? Do you know why you can't answer this question? You've allowed pride to take hold of you. You're proud, and you're the only student with whom I meet privately. Because of your lofty bearing, you're not able to solve this problem." Rav Yaakov Karliner burst into tears. At this point, the Rosh Yeshiva hugged him and assured him that he would soon solve the point in question. Indeed, within a few minutes, Rav Yaakov Karliner resolved the difficulty. Rav Soloveitchik broke into his characteristic smile, and he exclaimed, "How do I know that this is a true story? Because the son of one of the Volozhiner students who hid on the roof told the story to my father. My father related the details to me. I know the exact Tosfos. I know the question and the answer." How great is that? One of the kids, I'll call him a kid, one of the kids, the kid compared to me age-wise, I'm sure. One of the kids got on top of the yeshiva. He later himself marries and has a child, and the child, my goodness, Rav Chaim Volozhiner passed away. Now, let's try to understand this. Rav Chaim Volozhiner passed away in the year 1821. This had to happen on or before 1821, this story. A guy gets up on the roof of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. Let's imagine he's 20 years old. I'm going to go along with that. Why not? Maybe he was 22 to 18. I don't know. But 20 sounds right. So he's 20 years old in 1820, let's imagine. And he gets married as a child. And that child tells Reb Moshe Soloveitchik the story that his father got on a roof and heard Chaim Volozhiner himself, the disciple of the Vilna Gaon, the conversation he had with Reb Yaakov Karliner in the privacy of his study. This guy, this child, got it from his father who was on the roof or heard the whole thing. And he then relays these words to Moshe Soloveitchik. But Moshe Soloveitchik, the son of the Beis HaLevi, then transmits it to his son, Rav Yashaber Soloveitchik, who tells it to the whole wide world. So we know of a story that's got real legs to it, that happened 200 years ago. And it was given over by Rabbi Soloveitchik in or around the year, it's hard to know, exactly when Rabbi Soloveitchik gave over this particular story, but he's giving over a 200-year-old story. So, a couple of decades here or there. How about that? I like that. We continue. Amalek, top page 167. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on the duties of the king to the RCA in 1971. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, I heard from my father that any nation or group of people which declares war on the Jew and whose objective is the extermination of the Jew is classified as Amalek. Amalek is a movement. There's no doubt that the Nazis were Amalekim. There is no doubt about this. I'm not speaking from an emotional viewpoint, but from a halachic viewpoint. And who else do you think, by the way, who else can we say would be Amalek today? Who else wants to destroy the Jewish people? Well, the PLO, Hamas, ISIS, Hezbollah, we have a lot of enemies. Iran, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, hardline leftists, everybody hates the Jews. It's like a Mickey, Hickey Friedman. Oh my goodness. He was a funny composer. Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys. That was the name of the group. Something Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys. It was like a musical group. And he had a song like, the Hindus hate the Muslims, and the Muslims hate the Christians, and the Christians hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. So that's the song. Not a very musical song. I'm not sure exactly how many albums they sold. But the sentiment is true. I mean, everybody hates the Jews. We continue. Everybody's an Amalek out there. Except the South Koreans. South Koreans respect the Jews. They study the Talmud. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. That's what I remember reading. If they're into the Talmud, go figure. They want to know the Jews are smart, they feel. So what makes them smart? The study of the Talmud. No, there are plenty of Jews who never saw a Talmud in their life. And they got PhDs from Caltech. And they don't know the first thing from a Brisa to a Mishnah. And they're smart too. I don't know. Anyway, but they study the Talmud. Sazer Soloveitchik, I heard the following story about Rabbi Tzvi Volozhiner, who himself was he succeeded his father, Chaim Volozhiner, and Rabbi Isaac ben Chaim Volozhiner, who was born in 1780 and passed in 1849. He took over the Volozhiner Yeshiva on the passing of his father, Rabbi Chaim, and he appeared together one day, Rabbi Tzvi Volozhiner, appeared, this is an interesting story. He appeared together with the author of the Tzemach Tzedek, the Menachem Mendel Schneerson of Lubavitch, who lived 1789 to 1866. They appeared before Nicholas I, the Tsar of Russia, the Tsar. Certainly he's a Tsar. There's no question he was a troublemaker. He was a Tsar from 1825 to 1855. This was the first time that a representative of Chabad met with a representative of the Gaon school. Together, they coordinated their efforts in order to petition the government. At that time, the Russian government wanted to expel all the Jews from many villages. An edict was about to be issued that limited the areas in Russia where Jews could own real estate. Many Jews were to be expelled and their properties confiscated. The Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Volozhiner Rosh Yeshiva went to Petersburg. Well, St. Petersburg is the name of the town. I guess they didn't want to put the word saint in there. Some Lubavitch, that's how they call. They don't want to say the word saint. So they say we live in Antonio. They live in Francisco. I mean, I don't know how to. Where do you live? Jose. I mean, what do you live? Lewis. I don't know. They don't live in St. Paul. They live in Paul, up in Minnesota. Don't get me started. Many Jews were to be expelled and their properties confiscated. The Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Volozhiner Rosh Yeshiva went to St. Petersburg to petition the Tsar and have the edict rescinded. They lost and did not accomplish much. As they left the Tsar, Volozhiner went over to the Tzemach Tzedek, who himself was the grandson of the Bala Tanya. And he told him, I'm not a mind reader, but I know what you're thinking. Tzemach Tzedek turned around and said, How do you know? The Blitzer replied, I don't know how I know, but I can read your mind now. So the Tzemach Tzedek says, why? In Volozhin, they've started to practice Maipsim, miracles, like Mishra Sidim do? No, Mishra answered, no, it's not a Maipsim. Do you know what I have in mind? You thought that Nicholas was a typical representative of a Malik. That's exactly what I was thinking, was the reply of the Tzemach Tzedek. A Malik refers not only to a race, it is a movement, an ideology, a philosophy of hatred against the Jews. Next little piece, Rejecting Mussar, page 168, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Halachic Man. He writes, it would seem to me that this world perspective, that is, of course, of the Halachic Man, was the primary factor in the refusal on the part of such Halachic men as Rav Chaim Brisker, the Netziv of the Volozhin Yeshiva, and others, to admit the Mussar approach of Bissol Salanter into the Volozhin Yeshiva. The refusal on their part to allow Mussar into the Volozhin Yeshiva. What was it? It was the world perspective of the Halachic Man. So wait on this. Here we go. This movement, this Mussar movement, at the beginning of its development, symbolized the world perspective of the universal homo religiosus, a perspective directed towards the transcendent, toward that existence lying beyond the realm of concrete reality, the emotion of fear, the sense of lowliness, the melancholy, so typical of homo religiosus, which of course means religious man. Soloveitchik was going to compare and contrast religious man and halachic man. Religious man is your typical guy, and he's affected by emotions, and I guess he's fearful of death, and he's fearful of what's going to be, and this and that, and he's a bunch of fear rules his day. He is homo religiosus, religious man. The emotion of fear, the sense of lowliness, the melancholy so typical of homo religiosus, self-negation, constant self-appraisal, the consciousness of sin, self-lacerating torments, etc., etc., constituted the primary features of the movement's spiritual profile in its early years. It was the practice in Kovna and Slobodka to spend the twilight hour when the Shabbos was drawing to a close, in an atmosphere suffused with sadness and grief, an atmosphere in which man loses his spiritual shield, his sense of power, confidence, and strength, and becomes utterly sensitive and responsive, and then begins to engage in a monologue about death, the nihility of this world, its emptiness and ugliness. The halachic men of Brisk and Volozhin sensed that this whole mood posed a profound contradiction to the halacha and would undermine its very foundations. Halachic man fears nothing, for he swims in the sea of the Talmud, that life-giving sea to all the living. If a person has sinned, then the halacha of repentance will come to his aid. One must not waste time on spiritual self-appraisal, on probing introspections, and on the picking away at the sense of sin. Such a psychic analysis brings man neither to fear nor to love of God, nor, most fundamental of all, to the knowledge and cognition of the Torah. The Torah cannot be acquired in a state of melancholia and depression. Man's entire psychic being must be committed to the regime of the cognition of halacha, and it is through such service that man can be saved from experiencing despair. the disjunctive emotions of fear and anxiety, if not rooted in halacha, will give rise to destructive consequences that will far outweigh any supposed gains. Well known is Reb Chaim of Brisk's reply to Reb Yitzchak Blazer of Petersburg, a leading disciple of Reb Yisrael Salanter, when Reb Yitzchak Blazer, Reb Yitzchak Petterberger, came to Volozhin, which is in an attempt to persuade the heads of the yeshiva to introduce the study of Musar in their academy. Reb Yitzchak, in support of his position, cited the statement of the sages, a man should always incite the good impulse to fight against the evil impulse. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him remind himself of the day of death. Gemara Brachos 5a. Evidently, Reb Yitzchak emphasized the sages preferred the effectiveness of the remembrance of the day of death to the study of the Torah. For do we not have here stated that at times occupying oneself with Torah will not subdue the evil impulse, while the remembrance of the day of death will vanquish it? Reb Chaim replied, if a person is sick, we prescribe castor oil for him. However, it is certain that if a healthy person ingests castor oil, he will become very sick. If that vile wretch, meaning the evil impulse, meets you, and if you are sound in spirit and soul, if your consciousness and character are still whole and intact, then occupy yourself with the Torah. Drag him to the study house. See Gemara Sukkah 52b. See Gemara Kedushin 30b. This is the most effective and tried remedy in man's ongoing battle with his evil impulse. However, if you are spiritually sick, if a fit of madness has seized hold of you, if some psychic anomaly has put forth its disease tendrils in your inner world, then you must use more powerful drugs, those that are designed for the very ill. For instance, the remembrance of the day of death. We in Volozhin, thank God, are healthy in spirit and body. We are whole in our Torah. There is no need here of castor oil. If the scholars of Kelm and Kovna feel compelled to drink bitter drugs, let them drink to their heart's content. But let them not invite others to dine with them. And the Rabbi Soloveitchik continues, in all truth and fairness, it should be emphasized that when the Muslim movement reached a state of maturity in the yeshiva Knesset Yisrael in Slobodka under the leadership of Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, and in the Mir Yeshiva under the spiritual guidance of Rav Yochum Levavitz, it assumed an entirely different form and approached the world perspective of the great halachic men. The fear, the terror, the melancholy evaporated, and their place was taken by a powerful sense of the holiness and joy of life. The act of cognition in accordance with the halacha, new original halachic insights, spiritual creation, all replaced that exaggerated sensitivity and impressionability and that despairing perspective that had first taken hold of the world of the Musar movement. How about that? The originals were fighting the great ones of Volozhin were fighting the Musar yeshiva, the Musar Seder. That was part and parcel of some of the other big yeshivas like Kelm and Slobodka. How about that? Top page 171. We'll do one more little story, and this and we'll break because the next piece is all about the Beis Halev. Unresolved question. This was related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his annual Yahrzeit Shiur in memory of his father, January 15, 1956. He delivered it in Yiddish. In my youth, I asked my father, Rabbi Moshe, why the sages left so many questions unresolved and simply ended the Talmudical discussion with the word teku, which means the question remained unresolved. My father answered me by asking why there were chukim in the Torah, because chukim are statutes without any apparent human rationale. Why are there? Why are there mitzvahs that we have no idea what they're all about? He explained that God wished to teach us that not every event and happening can be comprehended by the limited mortal mind. Just as the Torah remains our eternal document, even with the chukim, similarly, a Jew must continue his eternal march before the Almighty, even though at times he does not comprehend the events that transpire around him. Likewise, my father held that the rabbis instituted the concept of teiku so that a Jew would understand that his faith must remain complete even when there are unresolved questions and events in his life. Even when a Jew is unsettled by problems, he must retain his Torah commitments. A mourner rends his clothes and is haunted by attempting to understand why his beloved one has departed this world. But he must still recite the blessing praising the true judge, Baruch Dayan HaEmes, blessed is the truthful judge, which is recited on learning of a death. Even after the Holocaust and so many vain attempts to understand the tragedy of the 6 million, the Jew must still declare, Michamocha Barayilam Hashem, who is like unto you, God, among the mighty? God has many questions and criticisms about the behavior of the Jewish people, but nonetheless, he is merciful toward them. Similarly, a Jew must emulate God, and his faith must remain firm, despite his doubts and inner conflicts. This is the secret of the Talmudical teiku and the Torah's chukim. You don't understand it? Keep living anyway. Just power through it. Maybe one day you will get it. Maybe you'll never get it. But you got to remain your Jewishness, got to retain it, got to be a good Jew, even in the teeth of not understanding every single thing. Top 172. At times, the teiku, this, you know, idea, oh, well, you know, when Eliyahu comes, he'll figure it out, unresolved. At times, the teiku in a person's life can be very great. It is the eve of Passover, and the mourner has just returned from burying his beloved parent. His anguish is overwhelming. His home is exactly the same as it had been when his parent was still alive. All the furniture is in place, and all the possessions of the departed are still intact. Only the deceased is missing, and he will never return. Well, we believe that he will, but not so fast. I mean, well, any minute Mashiach can come and resurrection of the dead. But at the moment, a person is not coming back if lost. Yet the mourner must rise from sitting Shiva because the festival abrogates its observance. He must dress in his holiday clothes and join his brethren in the synagogue. The mourner must acclaim the joyous verse of the Hallel. Zehayom Asa Hashem. This is the day which Hashem made. Nagila v'nismachavot. Let us be glad and rejoice on it. How can so sad a soul, at such a grievous moment, be required to say such words? The soul must do so because this is the halacha. This is the lesson of the teiku and the chukim. We must break down our emotions and surrender to the divine will. Once, on the first night of Shavuos, the students of the Vlajana Yeshiva returned from the festive meal to the Beis Midrash. The building was aglow with illumination and spiritual fervor. Some 400 students were engrossed in Talmudic study. Suddenly, the fatherly figure of the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva of Elohim, appeared in the Beis Medrash. In a loud voice, he declared, "Let us join together in a dance in honor of the Almighty's giving us the Torah." Soon, the entire student body was caught up in an ecstatic dance with the Netziv. In the midst of this dancing, a Gentile entered with a telegram for the Netziv. The telegram had already been opened, for the messenger knew that the recipient could not open it on the holy day. The Netziv read the telegram, placed it in his pocket, and continued dancing. Both days of the holiday continued in this joyful fashion. Finally, it ended as the concluding evening prayers were chanted and the Havdalah was recited. The moment after it ended, the Netziv broke down and began to sob without restraint. The telegram had informed him that his only sister had passed away on the day before Shavuos. Nevertheless, mourning can only begin after the festival and not on it. This is the demand of the halacha to which we must surrender. Only at the conclusion of the festival did the Netziv remove his shoes and break into uncontrollable tears. This is the demand of the Teku. With all his broken heart and his unanswered questions, the mortal man must yet exclaim, "Who is like unto thee, O God, among the mighty?" Beautiful stuff. The discipline that's required to continue to enjoy the holiday to the max and then be able to put it all away, clean up, whatever, and then when the Havdalah is made, then just to break down into an emotional puddle because one lost one's sibling. But up until that point, no way we're crying. The holiday doesn't allow for it. So there's no time to cry. You read it and you just keep on dancing. Once Havdalah is made, now you can revert back, you know, to being like whatever, homo religiosus, whatever. But while the Yontif is going on, it's Yontif, and there's no time for sadness. How about that? Amazing thought. I want to thank everybody for coming out today. Big Eshikayach. We knocked up the piece on Volozhin Yeshiva. God willing, next week, we hope to be on the road. Somehow, some way, we're going to be traveling. Going to pick up my mother-in-law in Albany at the Albany airport at around 4 o'clock or so. So I think we could find a time to take off an hour and explore of Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, because we got to sit and learn Torah too. I mean, come on. Let's just keep on going with this. And during the Kolamoid also, why not? So God willing, next week we'll be on the road, but we will look at the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, who lived in the 1800s. Wishing everybody a wonderful day. Hatzlacha bracha in your preparations for Pesach, cleaning, cooking, and so on. Everybody have a good one, and we'll see you tomorrow night, God willing, at 7:30 for Tanakh Tuesday at 7:30 as we continue to study 2 Kings. We'll finish chapter 16, and launch chapter 17 tomorrow. Have a great day today and a great one tomorrow. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.